WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Just a reminder that the Schuylkill has been closed between City Line and Conshohocken exits because of an overturned fuel truck which has spilled its stuff onto the expressway, so best to stay off the Schuylkill. With me back for a much-anticipated return visit to Fresh Air is Garrett Brown, who is known to filmmakers around the world as the man who invented the Steadicam. This is a camera that's hung by mounts and strapped to the camera person's body. Its amazing feature is that no matter how the camera person moves, walks, or runs, because of these mounts, the camera always keeps the same distance from the ground. The same relationship to the ground, maybe I should say. This camera has made it possible to shoot fluid scenes, following someone running up the stairs or turning corners, as scenes that would have needed a dolly or tracking. Long, complicated shots now can be shot very fluidly with just this camera strapped to one person. Needless to say, Brown and his invention have been very much in demand. In 1978, he won an Oscar for the Steadicam, and that was the first time in 10 years that an Oscar was given for a technical achievement. Since that time, he's continued to do shoots, as well as training other camera people to use his Steadicam. Although he's on location and traveling much of the time, Garrett Brown's home base is still Philadelphia. We asked him if he could come to Fresh Air today to talk about some of the films that he's recently worked on, so let me run down some of these films for you. He spent a year with Stanley Kubrick working on The Shining. He worked on Altered States, directed by Ken Russell, which just opened in New York. He worked on Willie and Phil, Can't Stop the Music, Fame, Xanadu, It's My Turn, The Formula, and the No Nukes movie. Films that he's worked on recently that haven't opened yet include Fort Apache, The Bronx, with Paul Newman, Four Friends, directed by Arthur Penn, Looking to Get Out, directed by Hal Ashby and starring John Voight, Strips with Bill Murray, True Confessions. With Bill Murray.
Strips sounds more interesting.
Yeah, I thought maybe he became a strip teaser. True Confessions with Robert De Niro, and he worked on Blowout, which is the scene that was the movie that was being shot here, directed by Robert De Niro with John Travolta. Garrett Brown, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really great to see you again.
Hi, Terry.
Been
nice
very
to be
busy
here.
Couple of years for you, I know. You were here in 1978, and that was, I think, shortly after the Steadicam won the Oscar. What are some of the
That must have been just before I went to England.
Right. Yeah, I think so. What are some of the things that have happened with you and the camera since then? Do you think the state of the art has changed in the past couple of years?
Well, I was virtually a hermit on the Kubrick film because I was there for the better part of a year. And finally, in the last portion of that year, I made a deal where I could commute weekly, a week here and a week there, which was great for me because I got back in touch with the industry. But actually, the camera, we made a lot of progress. Kubrick demanded certain things that hadn't been done previously, and we were able to jump into little English machine shops and make new bits and really work out some of the bugs in stuff we'll talk about later probably, but for instance, the camera can now be very low. I love the way you describe it, by the way, in terms of its relationship to the ground. I never quite thought of it that way.
Well, why don't you describe it?
That's good. I mean, of course, it really makes a camera stop shaking. That's the whole idea. The handheld thing has always been plagued by the jitters, as the advertising agency now puts it. And this thing sort of tunes out the shakes, and you can handhold a camera without it shaking. My relationship with the ground is uncertain at best. But, the center of the earth, maybe, that's it.
Okay. The Steadicams are showing up in a lot of movies. I always look at the credits now to see if there's a Steadicam operator, if your name appears. Can you always tell what was done with the Steadicam when you're watching?
Oh, yeah, I have a gimlet eye for the old frame line. It almost has spoiled me for looking at movies in the normal sense. I mean, I watch the frame line and I'm off on a speculation about exactly how or even who shot a scene. I can now sort of detect the signature of various people. There's one fellow on the West Coast who's excessively strong, I would have to say, and he grabs the thing very tightly, and it's a very distinctive style of motion. In fact, I suspect that it is his very excellent shot in Raging Bull that takes De Niro out of his, whatever you call it, locker room and right into the ring for his last shot of a spectacular shot. Of course, we were sitting there jubilant because I worked on the film a day, but I didn't even know that somebody had used it. You know, so I get these kind of surprises in the theater.
What gives it away when you're watching a film that a Steadicam was used?
Well, if the better it's used, the only chance you have that you know that that was it is it's a shot that otherwise would have been impossible. I hate to say it sounds very immodest, but You know, if you see the camera going on, looking forward and going on up over bumps or ridges or stairs or whatever, then you know immediately that either they spent a fortune to do something in the conventional style or that one of our intrepids was in there in the harness and doing it, you know.
Let me ask you to just take out a minute and describe the camera.
Well, it's an attempt to make a cameraman who was formerly a very immobile character as mobile as the rest of humanity, really. And it is a sort of fitted vest that goes on the body, and then it's a mechanical arm that never gets tired, which is attached to this vest. And the mechanical arm lifts the weight of a camera and a few other bits and pieces, a video viewfinder, since clearly if you're running along and you're bumping up and down and the camera's sailing straight, any attempt to have your eye on the viewfinder would cause what they used to call an occlusion. And the camera itself is rendered stable out on the end of this arm just by simply being a big inert heap of junk and not having much influencing it. What, by the time your moves, be it tap dancing or gliding along, get to the camera, they're all sort of tuned out by the arm. So there's a distressingly high amount of skill needed to work the thing still, but you know, you could say that about skiing or playing the violin or making a pizza. I mean, it all does. You don't just wander in there day one and pick it up and make a good pizza, I wouldn't guess, anyway.
Well, there's a lot of really general things I want to talk to you about filmmaking and shooting with the Steadicam, but I'm really anxious to hear first about the Kubrick film, The Shining, that you spent about a year working on. You'd seen Kubrick films before working on The Shining.
Yes.
How did your opinion of who he was as a director change from having seen his films before working with him and having considered what it was like to work with him?
Well, I mean, I went through the period which a number of people in the business, young people particularly, go through, in which Kubrick was just a godlike figure. I mean, sitting down in the front row of 2001 and under the influence of certain herbs, one does imagine that this is just all very wonderful, you know. By the time I got to England, this was tempered by, you know, growing up a little bit and by being more involved technically, and also by having spent some time with Kubrick just on in the planning stages. And, you know, he's human. He's a remarkable human soul. He's a virtual recluse. He's a very self-indulgent in the directorial sense, and because he can be, and I think, you know, most people who are self-indulgent are self-indulgent because A, they have the inclination to be so, but B, because somebody lets them, you know. He's one of the very few people working that still, or at least up until his last adventure, still had, you know, Final Cut, no interference, no studio guys hanging around, that kind of really super power in the film world. Events are moving in a contrary direction. Heaven's Gate, you know, dealt that whole scene a blow, I think, and so on. But, you know, Stanley is a megalithic character in film, and, you know, I have the greatest respect for his technical ability. I think, having now participated in this whole operation in England, I think it's time he came back to the U.S. I think he's been away too long. And I must hasten to say I'm not really all that eager to, you know, dissect Kubrick in an interview situation. It's sort of like dining out on one's tales from having worked there. I mean, you know what I mean? I'm really interested to discuss it, but, you know, there's a tendency in the third hand for somebody who was a minor cog in the wheel, really, which I was, to, you know, be taking all these grand views of how Stanley is and what sort of a director he is and why he did this and that, you know what I mean? I mean, I'll give you my little perspective, sure, on what all went on there, and particularly about, you know, where the crosshairs was to be and the frame and all that sort of business. But my opinion of him as a director is still, I still am, you know, somewhat in awe of his power as a director. Yeah. Disappointed in the film in many respects. But
when you were discussing with him how a shot would look, what would he go into with you? Would he, you know, tell you the ultimate things he was striving for, compositionally and in terms of meaning and symbolism and how it was to resonate throughout the rest of the film?
I certainly wish. In fact, I wish any director would sit down and tell me those things. I have yet to hear those things from anyone I've ever worked with. In fact, I suspect that if anyone did, I would probably regard them as a fool and not want to work with them at all. I mean, this is one of those visions that we have, you know, that there will be those discussions. You know, I mean, really, in fact, discussions about shots were beforehand very perfunctory as to, you know, starting here and ending there. And the rules of that game were established right from the beginning, which more later, if you like. I mean, Kubrick happens to fancy very symmetrical compositions. Well, Lord, I mean, there is only one symmetrical composition of any given scene, so that all that other stuff goes out the window. In fact, I used to think that my eye was hurt severely by my eye in the compositional sense was warped by sitting there for a year and concentrating on keeping everything in an absolute balance. I mean, there are some scenes that, you know, defy being balanced, so this is like counting the number of grains of an emulsion on the head of a pin. I mean, it's just, you know, it has nothing to do with all those things you just mentioned, the, you know, sensibilities of the shot and so on. So given the rule of a symmetrical composition, our discussions had to do with starting where, ending where, and how fast, you know, and that kind of thing. And there was a lot of attention to the mechanical details of putting a lens through space, that's all.
Did he tell you, like, what the edges of the frame should look like? Where?
Frequently.
Where a shot should begin and end?
Frequently. I came as close on that film to being a mechanical camera transporting device as I ever care to be, which I enjoyed as well. I mean, that was like, you know, being a gymnast. It's a form of approaching certain limits as closely as you can. For instance, when Stanley lines up a shot, he calls for a device called the tube, which is an artificial little ground glass and eyepiece so that he can see his actual lens, whatever it may be. So there's not the slightest variation between what he sees, as in a normal director's viewfinder, and what ends up on the screen. And then he calls for a plumb line to be dropped from where he's holding the lens, and a mark to be made on the floor giving the inches in height from the plumb line to the floor, and a brief discussion about where the crosshairs is. Now, this pretty much defines the shot as far as a level shot goes. There's no way that there's any variation. And then we would subsequently have articles as to arguments as to whether or not I was able to fly the lens into this, you know, perfect state of grace that he had described, you know.
You said that he wouldn't even get comfortable until about 14 takes and that his real ease came after about 20 takes. Was it frustrating to have to do the same take over so many times? Did
no.
it seem to change to you going
Sometimes,
through that?
Sometimes. I must say that it was good for me. I enjoyed it, as a matter of fact. I enjoyed a number of chances to do the same mechanical task over and over again. I mean, I did advance myself as far as my control over this beast while I was there, and it wasn't very arduous, really. I mean, you do a take, and then you have a playback on video, and then you have an argument about the playback, and then you have a coffee and bacon rolls or any other number of distractions, and then you do another one. I mean, a setup generally on his films lasts all day, so in some ways, it would be disappointing to Stanley to get a scene at, say, 3 p.m., because there's no chance of another setup at that pace, and certainly wouldn't want to let anyone off early, and, you know, what would one do with the rest of the day, so.
Well, you'd watch the dailies afterwards, and you'd see all the takes of one sequence. Do they look very different to you? What's the range that you'll
find? Sometimes, but frequently, no. I mean, frequently, the differences would be some nuance that he was striving for, and by that I mean either deliberately looking for something, for instance, a level of hysteria in Shelley Duvall that had not been previously plumbed or scaled, depending on the metaphor, and he might have been looking for just some accidental change in something, or he might like to compare, for instance, five perfect takes with this light turned on to five perfect takes with it turned off. I mean, it's very hard to make a judgment about somebody's ability as a filmmaker when they have that much freedom. And the reason I say that is, you understand what I mean. Whereas Stanley frequently would say how pleasant it would be to just make a good film and not be required by his reputation to make a perfect film, how pleasant it would be to breeze into a set and, okay, that's fine, and make hundreds of setups and just be fast, you know, and I'm sure he could be very fast and quite good and, you know, heaven, I must think that even in some cases he would be better because there is too much time at times. There's too much opportunity to sit and ponder something that's really too trivial to be pondered that much, you know. So, you know, it's a burden all that time, and you can't make a judgment about his skill, therefore, really, just based on all that, you know. It makes him sound crazy. In other words, if you say, well, then he did five this way and five that way, but you know, he did what he did because he was able to do it in some ways.
A shot that a lot of people, both civilians and critics who saw the movie, walked away talking about was the shot of the young boy. The movie takes place in this huge, empty hotel, practically empty except for this one family who's watching over it during the winter when there's just endless feet of snow that fall. But there's a son on a little, a young boy who rides a little tricycle over one of the, I think it's through a hallway or through one of the rooms, and there's an area of wood and an area of rug and then wood and rug that he drives over, at least that's how I recall it. And you can describe what the camera does with that. But I remember reading Pauline Kael's review, and the way I remember what she said about that shot was that it was a really beautiful done shot, but it's an example of like the technology and technical expertise being really terrific, but of an unnecessary shot in a way, since she didn't really see what the purpose of that shot was in the film. Can you tell us what you did with that shot and what that shot meant to you?
Well, that shot has got a lot of attention, and I have to say right away that, you know, in some ways the reaction to the film and the film itself was disappointing to a lot of people, Pauline Kael among them, for a number of reasons. And when you see the reaction that that shot gets, for instance, obviously in your mind, in your dream as you're filming it, you would hope that this film would be a legendary film. I mean, everyone working on almost any film hopes that it will be the best film ever made. In fact, the illusions and the delusions of people working on films are a subject for another film indeed, because they all are crazy. They all think they'll be wonderful and so on. Now, we hope that the whole film would have that level of impact on people. I mean, obviously, in your dream, you would hope, you would imagine that people will run screaming from the theater, that it'll be the most whatever it's going to be of all time, right? And there were a few moments in the film, but that one really is up on kind of a pinnacle. I mean, people really got an extraordinary charge out of that shot, and I don't think for the wrong reasons. I think Miss Kael is wrong in this case, because the film, first of all, marvelously, the shot showed you the geography of the hotel wonderfully well. And it gave you that sort of sense that is the opposite of claustrophobia, that some sort of terrible sense of insignificance, the little figures in this huge place, you know. And also, I found it very menacing to look at, first of all, because the camera was unearthly smooth, and for which we'll cheerfully take the credit, and because that sort of implies some sort of low, you know, you don't think it in so many words, but some sort of low, just absolutely wonderfully powerful point of view that is pursuing this kid on the bike. So subconsciously, your sense of unease is very much augmented by that shot. So I think she may have taken exception to the amount of sort of maybe the length of time it ran on screen, or even possibly to the extent that Stanley used me. I'm not sure. I mean, she may have taken exception to all the smooth tracking in the film as an apologia for not having something else to say. You know, who knows? I found that a wonderful review and as baffling as the film in some ways. So, but for me, I love that shot.
Yeah, I liked it too. And it would it have been possible without the Steadicam to get a shot whose point of view is the bottom of a wheel of a tricycle?
I don't know of any way. Well, I don't know of any way to get that shot and preserve that quality on screen. In other words, you could get that shot by bounding over the rug. There are a number of soft, tired creatures in the world, including, believe it or not, an old Citroën 2CV chassis still lurking on the stage in England that you could push around the set, possibly. But I think the results wouldn't have been as thrilling as that. First of all, you couldn't run a big thing right behind a kid in a tricycle. If you fell over, you'd run him over and you'd have to call for the next kid. So, you know, I think we scored big with that one. People aren't aware of it, but I actually shot 60% or so of the screen time on the film. Mostly things that you wouldn't stop and think, oh, a Steadicam shot. I did them because I was there every day, and I've very seldom had that luxury on a picture to be there and also to do the little routine stuff. You know, I get called in for the big extravaganza, you know, but it's fun also to just do a shot where the camera's here and moves up to here and holds and somebody enters and there's a little hysteria and somebody else enters. I mean, that's fun.
Do people usually call you up for the big stunt?
I get a lot of that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, big shots that are... it depends on how well whoever it is understands the machine. Unfortunately, our early reputation was derived from you know, running up and down stairs and things like that. And so there's still a lot of people that only think of me or the camera when there's stairs around or alligators to jump over or, you know, windows to fall out of or all that sort of stuff. I must say that I have grown inwardly when those calls come in. I like the I like other reasons to exist than that, you know. In fact, there was a shot on a film called True Confessions. And it was great fun for me, and it was also very interesting, and it was an example of just exactly the sort of thing I like to do. And the scene is a wedding in the 40s, beautiful period wedding in an old church in Los Angeles. And they determined that the aisle, the structure, wasn't strong enough to take the normal crane. And the original idea had been a descending crane shot coming up the aisle. And the more they looked into that and what would be involved in supporting the church, they didn't like the idea. So what they ended up doing was myself was mounted up on a thing called a Western dolly, which is just a big rubber-tired thing, which was wide enough to straddle the silk runner so they didn't have to put a new one in every take, you know. And I was on a ladder, a 14-foot ladder on this dolly, and I descended the ladder as they pushed the dolly silently up the aisle. And at the end of the aisle, I had them bump the thing into the first altar step, because that way you don't have to look down. You know when you're there because you feel the bump. You step off, you know you're there. I went over to the, flew the camera up over the bride and groom, the groom being a stuntman, so that when I tapped him, meaning he was out of the frame, he would leap out of the way like a frog, fly the lens over the bride, tap a priest as soon as the mat box passes his shoulder so that he's out of my shot, and he, a stuntman, flew away out of the shot and disappeared. And up just behind De Niro, who was facing the altar, and then who turned around on cue and, you know, did some Latin, right? Well, I mean, when we went down the aisle, this thing, first of all, looked like Wellington's funeral procession, this bizarre guy holding some kind of heraldic device descending a ladder in this contraption, right? And he bumps the altar rail, is propelled off the thing. The groom springs away like a frog. Well, the 700 extras are laughing every take, hysterical with laughter. I mean, they couldn't use the track because it's laughter every time. This is a very humorous-looking thing, this guy and this bizarre creature and down the aisle and, you know, the pose and everything about it was bizarre, right? And then to have a priest go rolling away, this is also contrary to everybody's idea of what a priest should do. And then finally to have De Niro turn around and with an absolutely straight face every take for about four takes and deliver his Latin line, I couldn't believe how good he was, how incredibly concentrated he was, because in the background it would be like, you know, stepping up to the stage on The Tonight Show and trying to deliver a serious bit of business. I mean, to me, that is the most fun, a shot like that.
So that required you to be a kind of a stuntman and required the camera to do very bizarre things, but it was worth it because it was such a spectacular shot.
Yeah, I felt real useful that day.
What are some of your other favorite shots that you've done?
Oh, Lord, that's difficult to say.
We'll narrow it down. Recent favorite shots.
Oh, some of them are my favorites because I managed to get through them all right, but at the time I was wishing for any other profession, tailor or astronaut or anything but what I was doing. I did a shot on a camera car in Spain on this Warren Beatty film, and the shot required that, even though it was very windy, and this is anathema to Steadicam operators, they don't like wind, required that a big wide shot of the planes with a little train approaching be absolutely still. And meanwhile, we're rushing over, you know, pasture and ruts and things in this camera car. And then there are Arabs and all kinds of tribal persons in the foreground hooping and hollering, and the train is coming along. And then I have to get off the camera car and walk through an arch, and they light three very expensive effigies, and they burn merrily as I walk by. And then I have to pick out Warren, who's getting off this train among hundreds of bodies. And, of course, you're looking at a little video viewfinder. And fiercely difficult shot. And I did a rehearsal, and Warren looked at the video, sort of remote video, and said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, I think it's going to be okay. And he said, I think it's a disaster. And, of course, now the pressure is really on. I'm saying, well, Warren, I think I can put some flags up, and we'll get it somehow. And voice going up an octave, and then, you know, eventually we got the shot, and they did manage to get the effigies lit and so on, and there were three sets, and we used all three sets because of the first time I was hit by a water buffalo and forced right out of the... I mean, it was unbelievable. Right? But when it's over, you know, when it's time to relax and you're back at your squalid hotel in Seville and you got the shot, well, then that's a good feeling. It really is.
Well, have you ever had a shot like that that's been spectacular and after hours of working on it, you finally gotten it and found that it's been edited out of the final movie?
Frequently.
Is it heartbreaking?
Well, I try to adjust to these things, these disasters. I mean, frequently you can sense a lot of enthusiasm building for lengthening a shot, and you'll be on the streets of New York, and it's in daytime, and it's cloudy, and there's no obstacle to just looking anywhere, and shots will go on for blocks, and if you just know that the editors will get their teeth into that, and you'll be decimated on the screen, and it's just a case of local enthusiasm, you know. Also, sometimes a director will say, particularly a new director, will say, okay, wander in there among the pachyderms or whatever it happens to be that you're shooting, and just get me some coverage. And he'll go off to lunch or the trailer or to wherever he can't be found for the next hour, and you just shoot on and on until somebody from production says, perhaps you shouldn't shoot any more film on these elephants, you know. And you know, not very little of that is going to end up on the screen. So, you know, there are different opportunities. I generally, in almost every picture, there's a shot that is just, you know, terribly exciting to you. In the Muse film, in the No Nukes film, there was a little shot from the back of the stage that would be spectacularly uninteresting to anybody but a cameraman, and that, you know, a cameraman would know right away that what we were doing was just not only impossible, but nearly impossible for the Steadicam. Extremely long focal length, and, you know, threading our way over amplifiers and wires and things, and holding this very tight little frame on people as seen in between performers in the foreground. We're seeing people way out into the audience, and yet we're moving past all this, the whole band, you know. And people next to me in the theater were justifiably confused when I was leaping up and down and hooting over this shot when we finally saw the film.
Yeah. Garrett Brown is my guest. We're talking about his invention, the Steadicam, and he has shot on many, many films. I've seen a lot of really bad films as well as a lot of really terrific films, and when you get called up to do a movie, you don't know in advance probably whether something's going to end up being a real turkey or a film that will endure and get shown at the retrospectives at all of the museums around the country. So do you care at the time when you're called for a job whether it's going to be a good film or not?
Well, I didn't used to in particular, because every day was a new opportunity to do whatever it is I do. But nowadays, if you get a call from, you know, the dismembering of Martha or some obviously dicey little item, I have my usual reservations about the content, and I have new reservations I've learned the hard way about pictures that go bankrupt. I just finally worked on one that went under and owing me a lot of dough, and that was a new experience. So, I mean, one of your criteria would be, is this a solid operation, you know? And the other, really, as far as artistic judgment, it's very hard to know in advance. I mean, I thought Rocky was going to be a sort of B picture just in the early stages. I mean, who knew, you know? And I failed to understand that The Exorcist 2 was going to be quite as much of a disaster as it turned out to be, The Heretic. It's very difficult on the set to know, again, this process of illusion, you know, with everybody. I've been working on some comedies lately, and everybody is frantically laughing in the screening room. And, you know, if you can just back off a couple of paces, you can realize, wait a second, this isn't that funny. And finally, when it gets down to the Budco 1, 2, 3 and so on, it's not going to be, you know, it's just not going to be all that humorous. So you have to sort of disregard this great universal wish among crew members that the thing be good, you know.
What would have been some of your disappointments in terms of a film that looked like it was going to be really good turning out to be pretty dull?
Well, let's see, what was going to look good? I think The Heretic was the biggest one. I had no idea what the film would be like. I began to suspect that it was a turkey. But another one that, from my perspective, which is being on the set for a week or whatever, and I was doing roller skating shots with Gene Kelly on a film called Xanadu, and that was a disappointment to me in many respects. And you just never know, you know. You're in the midst of the crew, and then you're going, particularly myself, who is not generally on the whole time, you know. I come in and I say hello to everybody and try and remember everybody's name and shoot for a few days, and then I'm gone. And I give up. I mean, I can't tell whether anything's going to be good or not, unless it's just one of those aforementioned real gross things, you know.
When you're going to the movies, say a movie that you haven't worked on, that you're watching with fresh eyes, you haven't seen it before, you haven't worked on it, well, how do you watch it as far as the camera movements, as far as composition and framing and all that? What do you look for?
Well, I try and not even think about all that, and I try and get uninvolved with it unless something is either so great or so terrible that you're drawn out of it. I try to just watch the movie. I'm unsuccessful more often than I would like to be, because if there's a scene that, you know, I wish I had shot, for instance, or a scene that really cried out for our thing, well, that, you know, that gets in the way of seeing a film. It used to be some years ago that you would go to a film and somebody would be using the Steadicam or the version which we licensed to Panavision called the Panaglide, and you would see this thing in use, and if the shot was poorly executed, that would be just, you know, I'd want to climb under the chair. And it doesn't help that nobody else in the theater cares, you know, that nobody even notices it. You know, I would see it as a blow to the future of this gadget, you know, if somebody uses it badly. So it's hard to be objective anymore. I know this is a common refrain among people in the business, but, you know, one tries. I mean, there are films that just, you know, knock you out. And, I mean, and in the middle of Raging Bull, I was very involved in that film, and I almost got entirely through this great Steadicam shot before I suddenly realized, oh, yes, this is terrific, you know. And that spoiled the next 10 minutes of the film for me because I was thinking about that shot.
Mm-hmm. So you try not to really think of it in those kinds of technical terms. There's some great debates that go on between against civilians and in some of the critical reviews over who's responsible for the beauty or brilliant cinematography in the movie. Is it the director's vision or what the cinematographer brought with him or her to the movie? Do you have any rules of thumb for deciding who's to credit or who's to blame for the look of a film?
No, not really. Every case is different. Nestor Almendros, for instance, won an Oscar for Days of Heaven. Nestor freely credits Terry Malick, who's a very visual guy, evidently, with a lot of the wonderful things that went on screen there. And Nestor is, you know, no slouch as a cameraman himself. But it's really impossible to make any sort of rule of thumb. I go on a picture hoping that the DP, or director of photography, is the strong character. But as I think about it, I've been on a lot of pictures where the DP could have done with a little less power and the director could have had more. So every case is different. It's a very peculiar relationship, really. It's like, I can't imagine an analogous relationship in, say, the art world. Suppose there was a guy who laid paint on and there was another guy who was the director of a painting. Can you imagine the chaos if somebody was to apply the brush strokes and somebody else was to tell him in some sort of English words, or Italian more likely for this particular whimsy, where to apply the paint? I mean, that's sort of what we're into here, you know, and it's very strange.
No, so many people are just dying to get onto a film set and be able to see what happens there and witness it all firsthand. I think of it as being really terribly glamorous profession to be in. Does it seem glamorous to you, having spent so much time making movies?
No, glamorous isn't a word that I would have thought of. I mean, it is interesting to me, and mostly it's interesting because of the relationships of the people doing it, and also because of every now and then the magic that happens when somebody can really perform, and you can sit there watching them, and you can forget that there are 50 other souls standing around with cups of coffee in their hand when somebody is really terrific. So that is worth waiting for. But basically, it's just a very odd, virtually undignified profession to be in. I mean, there are just things that happen to actors and crew people alike that are ridiculous, you know. It's sort of the conflict between the American way of life and the need for a hot meal, sit down, one a day, the clean motel with bath in each room, and the demands of location filmmaking. I mean, I was sitting on this actually was on the studio about a week ago and watched the stunt dog, the trained dog, eating the food in front of Eve Arden, who looked down almost about to take a bite of this particular item as required by the scene, and just realized at the last instant that the dog had reached over and snuck a pork chop or whatever it was. I mean, just very strange things, you know, and there's no way to get that on the screen. It has nothing to do with the movie. It's just a bit of the old human drama, you know, going down.
Do you have to do reaction shots? Are those hard to do? Say someone was filming us doing this conversation and I was supposed to be hysterical crying because of something you just said, and say this is a shot that's being taken of me long after you've left the set, but I'm supposed to be reacting to you, but you're not really there anymore, but the camera just needs to be on me, so I'll just be hysterical with the camera on me, reacting
to
nothing.
That's easy for the cameraman, hard for the actress, depending on how remote is the event. You know?
Do you empathize with that? Do you get into what the actors are having to do?
I don't know. My relationship to actors varies between that of a, you know, a dolly, a glorified dolly, where I'm in and out and really I don't know them as people and I don't know the script that well. I may have had a copy to read on the plane, but, you know, I really can't contribute in any meaningful way to the dramatic process. So basically I'm a, you know, a pusher of aluminum. I push the camera around and I try to make their lives as easy as I can in certain ways. At other times, if I'm involved more, you know, a more lengthy involvement, or if it's a really slick bit of choreography that involves some kind of interaction between me and the actors, you know, running, stopping, having fits, well, that's good. But basically, my view of actors is as, you know, as a layman, really. I'm not I'm not really all that involved in them. It's hard for me, for instance, to comment on performance. Unlike the average good operator who is watching through his viewfinder a color picture, and it can sometimes help by saying, wait a minute, I really think she needs to be a little this, or I saw that she was reading a cue card, or I saw that the tears aren't real, or the glycerin is, you know, all that kind of help I'm unable to give because, first of all, I'm looking at a little green video picture of the events, you know, populated by little green blobs who I know to be actors. And secondly, to operate this thing uses up a lot of circuits, I'll tell you. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, you're navigating through the world. You can't fall down. That's A. And B, you have to compose the scene. And C, you have to hit all the marks, which are invisible little bits of detritus on the floor. And D, you have to, frame in just such a way and make all your moves. And, I mean, you just are out of circuits. If somebody says to me, did you see whether somebody rather looked at the camera, I just have to laugh because I would hardly have noticed if a water buffalo had walked through the scene. You know, you get so involved in just getting the thing through the scene. So, I can't give all the traditional services of the operator in some respects.
Yeah. What makes a good director on your end of things? And who?
For me, I like a guy that understands what the machine can do and uses some imagination to get on with the business of filmmaking. I don't care if he devises a great scene for me. I just like, you know, the camera used as a filmmaking tool and used well. I mean, you know, for instance, one of the problems in the business, and stop me if you don't want to get involved in this, but one of the problems is how do you shoot on location streets without attracting a big crowd and needing cops and needing, you know, eventually to put up arcs because it took so long to get it that the light has changed, all that stuff, right? I like to work with people that have thought this through and that realize, for instance, that with a Steadicam, you can hide until you're ready to get the shot, jump out of a doorway, hold the camera still enough that it looks like a tripod shot, and get a shot before the crowd appears. And then to do the reverse, you can stroll away, leaving the gawkers behind, and then make your reverse angle somewhere else. Or you can pop out of a doorway, walk along with somebody, getting, let's say, a two-shot of two people talking, go and hide again, you know, let the street calm down, pop out, make the reverse, let's say a single on one of those two people. And let's say that in the first shot, somebody walked by, turned back, and gawked, a big Class A, 100% flashing gawk right in the camera. Well, you know, my ideal man will realize that in the reverse angle, that first guy is not there anymore, he's long gone, and most likely in that reverse angle, you know, the only gawker will be somebody else, you know, 50 yards further along, so he can use the reverse possibly for the time, you know, when the gawking happens. So, obviously, if you want perfection, complete control over the medium, you've got to own the street because you may not want to cut during that point. But if you're making a film, and in the real world, it doesn't so much matter who you're on right here, you know, if it really is okay, then I love that. It's, you know, getting on with filmmaking. It's
when you're doing location shooting and there's, say it's on a populated city street and there's supposed to be a lot of passersby, are they ever not extras but real people on the real street, unaware of what's happening?
Frequently, it depends. If you can steal it, frequently, yes. Sometimes this is done from concealed camera cars or very bizarre-looking newsstands, which the art director imagined looked like a real newsstand, but for some reason it has a big canvas with a hole in it and lots of people with walkie-talkies hanging around. I mean, you know, it's more or less successfully, things are stolen more or less successfully now and then.
You did some shooting recently, I guess it was in Philadelphia, because it was for the film Blowout, most of which was shot here, directed by Brian De Palma, and that was the film that John Travolta's been in town for. Was it different shooting in your home city?
Well, it's fun for me. I don't get a chance to work at home very frequently, and that's great. I loved it. When the Rockies come in or something like this, that's about the only chance.
What kind of direction would De Palma give you in terms of what he was looking for in a shot?
Well, that's it's hard to say. I mean, De Palma's style of directing is his own. I mean, he's not a big communicator with technicians such as myself. I mean, somehow I'm led to understand what's happening, but, you know, it isn't by a long, earnest chat as you were imagining with Brian in his hotel room before the, you know, I mean, it's his style. I mean, I must say the shot that I did for him was extremely well designed. I was very impressed with it. I mean, every aspect of it was carefully thought out, and I presume he did that. And his cinematographer is a legendary character as well, so the two of them worked together quite nicely.
I heard him on the Dick Cavett Show once, I think, with Martin Scorsese, and I forget who else. And I think it was him who said that before he does a film, he hangs up around his room the diagrams of all the shots that he's going to want and the sequence that they're to be shot in. Did it seem that way to you, that there was that things were all ordered in that in specificity in advance?
Yeah, in the positive sense, yes. I mean, they were not lacking flexibility as far as if there was a door that didn't happen to be where they wanted it. It, you know, we lived with it or moved it or changed. You know, it was very clear to me that they, and again, I assume it's Brian, first of all, knew precisely what they wanted. I did a sequence that was shot out at Swarthmore College and was not really a street location sort of thing, but every frame was in place, I must say.
How much are you going to risk for a shot, for any director, for any film, no matter how great the film's going to be? Because I'm thinking of some of the shots that you described and how, to me, I don't know, there seem to be tremendous opportunities to
crash.
Fall flat on your face and break a leg while you're shooting at it, because in a way you and your camera are stunt people for some of the shots you've been called on to do. I don't know what kind of acrobatic or body training you have, but would you be willing to do a risky shot?
No, I don't have a stuntman's mentality. I must say I'm less and less willing to take material risks with my legs or my, you know, hands or whatever in a shot. I at least am very unenthusiastic if someone calls up foaming at the mouth over this chance to, you know, run down the icy stairs or dodge around among cars or put on roller skates or what have you. So lately my style is to thoroughly pre-produce everything, in other words, to make sure that it can be rendered safe, and in other words that there's no real measurable chance of myself, you know, crashing on it, aside from, you know, the odd just chance that you can't deal with, which could happen any time, such as falling down or something odd, banana peels or something. I scrape all the banana peels off and all the usual bits. I mean, I had a shot. I was asked on a film called The Wolfen to shoot as I climbed up the cable on the Brooklyn Bridge. And my first reaction was horror, absolute horror. I knew they needed the shot. I know the sequence. I knew also that the only legitimate traveling shot up that cable would either be a real short one from a crane on the low end, but you know, once you get up the cable, forget it. It's going to be, or maybe some kind of helicopter, but that's not really a good way either. So what I said was, all right, I mean, I'll go down there and we'll scout it. You can put me on the payroll. We'll check out whether it can humanly be done and safely. In other words, if you have a mountain climber coming right behind me who is skilled in the use of what they use on the bridge, which are these safety clips, and if he's holding me, can I do it, that kind of stuff. And I when I finally got on the bridge, and I didn't make that shot because they didn't have time to pre-produce it, and so we passed on it. We said, no, okay. But I did agree to climb the bridge and shoot on the top of the Brooklyn Bridge because it didn't involve shooting while I was actually on the cable. And I'm not sure I'd even do that again. I have a certain amount of acrophobia, and I mean, to be walking up that wire and looking down at the water, and the wire is disturbingly thin, and the things you're holding on to shake, and, you know, the whole crew of 40 souls went up there, but many of them unhappily. And once I got to the top, we made a fabulous shot on the top of the bridge. I mean, just one of the best shots I've ever made, you know, because, you know, how else are you going to, you can't lug a dolly up there. I mean, how else can you get this kind of a shot? I loved it. But I must say that on the way down the wire, I, again, thought that I must be a fool to be in this profession, you know, and was counting the steps till I was out of there, so... You know, I'm getting more careful. In the early days, I made shots that I look at now on screen, and I know how risky they are now better than I knew then. And I really is, I'm lucky, I think, that I've gotten through them all.
What kind of precautions do the people involved in the film take for you when you're on top of a bridge with a camera?
Well, they do whatever you pretty much insist on. I mean, there are people that stroll around and have no fear of height. Some legendary grips in New York, like Billy Miller, who, you know, can be found wherever there's height, cavorting around. People won't know in advance whether you're that kind of guy or not until you sit there and say, now, wait a minute, this is what I want. I want a rope attaching me to the center thing on the bridge, right? And so that rope we will measure out carefully so I can't go off the edge no matter what, you know, because a gust of wind, a misstep, a, you know, getting involved with the shot, as I was describing earlier, until you have no circuits left to warn you, psst, you're near the edge, pal. Hey, you better stop, you're near the edge. So, you know, I like to deal with that in advance. I'm getting good at that, actually. I'm getting good at setting things up and being firm enough in the beginning so that they know I'm serious and then I can be protected, you know. I think it's an exaggerated view of my own worth in some ways, but I really, I'd like to go on doing this for a while. It's
yeah,
fun,
really,
you know?
Really. You know, it's...
Ask me about the rhinoceros on the Ken Russell film.
Okay, the rhinoceros.
Do we have time?
Yes, on the Ken Russell film.
We had a scene in the Altered States, which is just released, where I'm in a pen with a rhinoceros in the Bronx Zoo, and between me and the rhinoceros is an actor who is portraying the ape man, as you will see when you see the film. And the ape man actor is so terrified that the fake hair on his back is actually standing on end. As every time we went in there, the rhino would turn, head toward us, and start going boom, 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 right toward us, right? And the reason that yours truly was in there was so I could make a decent shot, but then also whip out of there and all be clear, right, through the two-ton door, which they would then shut. And on one occasion, we didn't quite get through the two-ton door, and I had to blow what we call a quick release and just blows all the gear off, and then you can run away, you know. The rhino mercifully did not trample all over my gear. We all ducked through the door and left the equipment in a heap, still running, and so on. So, you know, having thought of the quick release some years before, I was just thrilled with myself that I had it along and that it worked, you know.
No, one thing that's really funny about all of this, like, film is the art of illusion, right? And on film, you're making things seem terribly dangerous and making it look like people are getting killed or that their lives are in danger. And, of course, they're really actors and their lives aren't in danger. But talking to you, I realize that actually a lot of times people's lives are in danger and it might not be the actors necessarily. It might be the cameraman, you, or you know, some other person involved with setting the scene up or filming it?
Yeah, I think there's a higher mortality rate among filmmakers than, say, accountants or, you know, telephone operators or something like that. I mean, there are some opportunities to plumber in, you know. There was just read about a camera car rolling over and 11 people on it, you know. I mean, you get nightmares about that stuff, you know.
People use the word Hollywood all the time to talk about where movies come from and who controls what we see. Does Hollywood exist anymore, you think?
Oh, yeah. Hollywood is really L.A. A lot of the studios that still exist aren't necessarily in Hollywood, but it is. Hollywood is still the place. I think there are places in the world that make many more films than in Hollywood, in India, for instance, but Hollywood is still the place. It's from Hollywood that location pictures frequently go out. New York has got a wonderful dynamic film industry, but it's different, you know. It's a different feeling than Hollywood. Hollywood still has that sort of magic. Even films that come here, for instance, frequently end up back in L.A. or in New York, depending, for the completion of the picture.
You still choose to live in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
What's your reasons for remaining based in the city?
Well, I mean, one of the main reasons is that I really do like it here. I think it's the best urban place to live I've ever seen in the country. And secondly, it's very easy for me to get to L.A. from here, and it's very difficult to get to L.A. from New York. And being an Eastern guy, I mean, I work in New York, and I can drive up there in an hour and a half, which is not bad. I can get to Los Angeles with far less hassles than a New Yorker just by, you know, 10 minutes to the airport and United 99, and I'm there by 11:30, and my car is parked here right down the corridor and so on. In New York, it's, you know, beat your way to Kennedy and impossible. So by the time you get to L.A., you've done a day's work in New York. Here, it's just, you know, a morning's activity.
That's a really good point. I know what you mean about getting to Kennedy. That's certainly true. What are some of the projects you have coming up?
Well, right now I'm on the new Coppola film called One from the Heart, which is a really remarkable project. It's a very theatrical film, meaning theatrical like the theater. Closed sets and forced perspective sets and all kinds of filmic illusions so that the actors can really run through their material almost television style with three cameras. We will have it thoroughly rehearsed before the cameras ever roll, and video recording of from the film camera so that Francis can cut it together, look at it, make any changes. And then he expects to shoot the entire picture in 3 weeks, which is faster than this sort of a film would normally be shot, all studio. And I'm, you know, my gadget is one of the three cameras, and it'll be exciting, you know, to be among, you know, whirring conventional technology, darting in and out, getting this scene, having another camera take over, hiding in the closet. I mean, half the drama
is... Sounds like an antidote to Apocalypse Now.
For him, yes.
Yeah, sure. That's what I mean, yeah.
And I'm on the film called Under the Rainbow, which is being done by a couple of Philadelphians about the little people who are in The Wizard of Oz. I mean, fantastic picture. And, you know, they keep calling, so it's busy.
Well, I wish you continued success, and I'll continue to look for your name on the credits of films. I've been speaking with Garrett Brown, who is based in Philadelphia and is usually spending his time traveling around working on films. He's the inventor of the Steadicam, which he received an Oscar for back in 1978, and he's got a lot of films that will be coming out soon.